and thank you for standing by. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of the conference. During that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. Brady Phillips. You may begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining this media call. Again, my name is Brady Phillips. I work with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. This call will feature four short presentations by NOAA and NASA leadership and some of our leading scientists on the 2014 global temperature data and some other key weather and climate highlights. It will be followed by a question-and-answer session. A copy of the presentation that our speakers will be speaking to can be downloaded at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BREFINGS. Today's presenters are Michael Freilich, he's the Director of NASA's Earth Science Division in the Science Mission Directorate in Washington. Richard Spinrad, NOAA's Chief Scientist, also here in Washington. Gavin Schmidt, the Director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. And Tom Carl, the Director of NOAA's National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina, and Chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. So our first speaker will be Michael Freilich from NASA.
Thank you, Brady, and thanks to all who are on the call. Climate change is perhaps the major challenge of our generation. Our changing climate presents us with vast opportunities as well as the potential for profound societal impacts. To understand how Earth is changing as a result of natural and human influences, we need to observe many aspects of this complex planet. Surface temperatures are among humankind's longest environmental data records, with measurements from instruments located across several continents dating all the way back to the 1880s. Surface temperature is one of many environmental variables that NASA and our partner agencies measure and monitor in order to provide objective information on how Earth and its climate are changing. NASA and NOAA scientists, in separate complementary analyses of surface temperature data from around the world, are today announcing that when averaged over the globe, 2014 was the warmest year on record. Now, to understand the Earth, we must not only understand individual processes that occur on and between the land, the oceans, and the atmosphere. Critically, we have to understand the connections and the interactions between processes as well. And to do this, we have to simultaneously measure many different quantities on many different space and many different time scales. The vantage point of space is revolutionizing our knowledge of our planet and its evolving environment. Satellite-borne instruments can measure with fine resolution over large areas and can measure frequently at each location over long periods of time, thus providing us with broad, integrated sets of uniformly high-quality data covering all parts of our planet. That's what NASA's Earth Observing Program does. Now, agencies like NASA and NOAA make accurate measurements and apply advanced scientific tools, including that most remarkable computational device, the human brain, to document and understand the processes, interactions, and changes that the measurements reveal. And we share this unique knowledge with the global community by providing our data and results broadly, transparently, and freely. Our measurements and analyses enable policymakers and the public to make sound and informed decisions on critical societal issues related to the environment. Now, NASA has a long and productive relationship with NOAA. People in both agencies are committed to working together to advance our understanding of Earth and our climate. In this month of January 2015 alone, NASA and NOAA, with our government partners in the Air Force and private sector partners in industry and academia, are launching three innovative Earth-observing missions into space, the Cloud Aerosol Transport System instrument, which launched last week and is now being installed on the space station, the SMAP mission to measure global soil moisture and freeze-thaw cycling, and the Discover space weather mission to provide critical measurements of our sun and the Earth from a vantage point a million miles away. We're truly harnessing our nation's unsurpassed technological and scientific skills to provide insights into our home planet and our environment. With this, I'd now like to give the floor to my friend and longtime colleague, Rick Spinrad, the chief scientist of NOAA. Rick?
Thank you, Mike, and good morning to everyone. Let me start by recognizing the many scientists in NOAA and NASA, and of course from our partners in other research institutions around the world who work tirelessly to maintain and improve our global observations and climate records. Without these global climate data, we would have no baseline from which to measure the state of our climate and how it changes with time. Today, NOAA and NASA are both reporting, as you just heard from Mike, that in 2014, the globe experienced the warmest average surface temperature on record, a robust climate record that dates back 135 years to 1880. You'll hear more details from Tom Carl and Gavin Schmidt shortly. As NOAA's chief scientist, I'm pleased to oversee a research enterprise that provides foundational weather and climate data needed for the environmental intelligence used every day by communities, businesses, and all levels of government across the nation. These data are the basis for the best available science-based information to help them prepare for and become more resilient to a changing planet. City planners, for example, in coastal areas, use our sea level data to help site critical infrastructure. Water managers in arid regions rely on our weekly drought updates to allocate water, and businesses use this information to reduce their risks and increase their competitive edge. However, before agencies like NOAA can provide this timely and trusted science-based information and expertise to decision makers, we need data, and lots of it, from all over the world. The oceans and atmosphere that drive climate know no boundaries, and so the source of our environmental intelligence is the vast array of observations and monitoring networks around the world. NOAA's observational infrastructure includes networks of ground-based stations, radars, satellites, buoys, ships, aircraft, tide gauges, and other platforms. Such data-intensive networks also demand a robust, high-performance computing infrastructure as well as long-term stewarding of the data. These are the basic tools that scientists need to take the pulse of our planet. We do not and cannot do this work alone. We rely on international organizations, such as the World Meteorological Organization, to promote international data exchange and collaboration. It's also critical that NASA and the UK Meteorological Office and the Japanese Meteorological Agency, for example, each have individual analyses of this global wealth of data. Multiple data sets from across the globe continue to validate each other and highlight the long-term trends that we are seeing. Without NOAA's environmental intelligence, including its global observation systems, and the science to analyze and model the data, we are unable to deliver information that saves lives, protects properties, and safeguards our economy. The better the data, the better our information to help people, communities, businesses anticipate, prepare for, and build a weather-ready and climate-smart nation and world. I'll now turn it over to Gavin Schmidt from NASA, who will provide some of the climate highlights from 2014.
Hi, thanks a lot. I'm the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and we collate one of the main analyses that we are going to talk about today. Tom Carl will discuss some of the details of the NOAA analysis. And the headline, obviously, as you probably anticipated and have already heard, 2014 was the warmest year in both of our records. And if we move on to slide two, you can see a map of where those anomalies were most evident. The baseline here is our climatology, which is 1951 to 1980. It's actually quite close to the mean over the whole century as well. And you can see the red parts are where we've had extreme anomalies this year, Alaska, the West Coast, Northwest Pacific, Europe, parts of Siberia, Australia. And you can see there's been a lot of warmth, mainly in the ocean. This was very clearly the record warmest year in the ocean records. It wasn't quite the warmest year in the land records, but combined, this did actually give the warmest year in both of our anomalies. So the anomaly that we give there, 0.68, is with respect to 1951 to 1980. With respect to the pre-industrial period, so say mid-19th century, it's more like 0.9 degrees Celsius, which is 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Tom.
Thank you, Gavin. I'm going to move on to slide three for those of you following on the slides. On that slide, you'll see for the globe a depiction of the temperatures in areas where we've had 80 or more years of data, depicted by whether or not they are much above normal, warmer than average, or record warmest. The color schemes in red are all warmer than average. The blue are cooler than average. And as you notice, first off, much of the map is red, and there's a considerable amount of area where we see the record highest temperatures observed. You'll notice many portions of Europe, every ocean had parts that were record warmest, and there are a few areas in some of the land areas where temperatures were actually cooler than average. Most notably is the North America area, particularly across the United States. Some regions were much cooler than average, but that was overwhelmed by the far greater proportion of land area and ocean area that was much warmer than average or record temperatures. So if you put it all together, it comes out to the warmest year on record. This is the ninth, for the 21st century, 9 out of 10 years have been warmest on record. 1998 was the only year prior to the 21st century that made the top 10. It was the fourth warmest. If we move on to slide 4, on slide 4 is a time series, two time series, in fact, one for the NASA data colored in red, the NOAA data colored in blue. You can see the two lines are on top of each other for much of the record. As was pointed out by Mike and Rick, we do have different analyses, independent analyses. But the overall trends from the NASA data from 1880 to the present time are in the order of 0.12 degrees Fahrenheit per decade, for the NOAA data in the order of 0.11 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And if we go from 1970 to present, the trends are significantly higher in the order of close to 0.3 of a degree Fahrenheit per decade since 1970. If we now move on to slide 5, both NASA and NOAA take a look at their uncertainties. Certainly there are uncertainties in putting all this together, all these data sets. But after considering the uncertainties, we have calculated the probability that 2014 versus other years that were relatively warm were actually the warmest year on record. And the way you can interpret these data tables is for the NOAA data, 2014 is 2.5 times more likely than the second warmest year on record, 2010,
to actually be the warmest on record after consideration of all the data uncertainties that we take into account. And for the NASA data, that number is in the order of about 1.5 times more likely than the second warmest year on their records, which again is 2010. So clearly 2014 in both our records were the warmest, and there's a fair bit of confidence that that is indeed the case, even considering data uncertainties. Also note that the Japanese Meteorological Agency announced their numbers for 2014 as also being the warmest on record. The UK Meteorological Office, we expect to announce shortly their numbers for 2014. On slide 6, we want to move on to what we saw above the planet's surface, looking at higher levels in the atmosphere, and you see the little depiction on the right side of that diagram, going into the troposphere and into the stratosphere. Temperatures are not the same in terms of what we saw near and close to the surface. If we look at the lower troposphere and the middle troposphere from a couple different data sets, one from the University of Alabama at Huntsville, one from remote sensing systems, these are climate data records that we've worked with those groups to provide to you. They were the third and sixth warmest, respectively. If we actually go to the lower stratosphere, 13th coolest. Now, this is not unexpected. We know the trend has been for the stratosphere to be cooler over time as opposed to warmer, both because of ozone influences and the way we know greenhouse gas operates in the stratosphere. For the troposphere, in the data sets that these represent, 1998 shows up as the warmest year on record. And for those of you who remember, 1998 was a year of a very strong El Nino event. When we have major El Ninos, there's a redistribution of heat from the ocean to the atmosphere. Much of that heat then is released into the atmosphere. Water evaporates from the oceans and condenses into the atmosphere, also adding more moisture into the atmosphere. So when you have an El Nino event, you've got very, very warm conditions in the middle of the troposphere. This year, we did not have a significant El Nino. In fact, even in November, December this year, we're very borderline whether or not we're even at a weak El Nino. And currently, we know the Japanese Meteorological Agency feels we're in a very weak El Nino in December. In terms of NOAA, we have not declared an El Nino yet, and it's unlikely that we'll have anything more than a weak El Nino as this year progresses. On the next slide, slide 7, we have trends of snow cover extent for the northern hemisphere. These are trends that go back to November of 1966. University of Rutgers, the Rutgers Global Snow Lab, we work closely with them in producing these data based on NOAA satellite information and other NASA satellite information. And what we see here is a tendency, these two charts, one is in percent changes per decade, the other one is the actual changes in the snow cover extent, the area of snow cover extent. We see significant decreases in the spring and early summer months. Why is this important? It's important because that's when the sun is high. A lot of additional heat then is gained because there's less snow to reflect the sunlight back to space. And what we saw this year in 2014 was a continuation of this pattern, both for snow cover in Eurasia and in North America in the spring and early summer, less snow cover extent. Now, that wasn't necessarily the case in North America in the middle of winter, and that's consistent with these trends that we see. That is, when it's cold enough, the snow, we don't see a substantial decrease during the cold winter months, but toward the transition season in spring, substantial decreases. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Gavin.
Thanks, Tom. Moving on to slide 8, we've been looking as well, of course, at the Arctic and Antarctic sea ice extent. And you can see in this graph, we've plotted the annual anomaly for the sea ice in both polar hemispheres. The Arctic sea ice is on a very clear downward trend. This last year was about the sixth lowest annual anomaly for the Arctic sea ice. And of course, you can see as well that in the Antarctic, 2014 was actually the highest Antarctic sea ice extent, which is a little surprising given the warmth in the rest of the planet. We did a little analysis to try and understand that. And if you look at the graph slightly to the right, the black dots and the blue dot are the relationship between our estimates of the temperatures in the Arctic region, 60 to 90 north, compared to the ice extent anomaly. And you can see that the black dots show a very clear pattern that when our data says that it's warm in the polar latitudes, we have a reduced amount of sea ice, as you might expect. In the southern hemisphere, that's the red dots, and then the green dot is the 2014 data, there isn't such a clear relationship. And that is an indication that the patterns of sea ice in Antarctica are both regionally more complicated than they are in the Arctic, and they're less determined by the overall temperature across that those polar latitudes. There are some interesting things going on in Antarctica related to changes in the winds driven by the ozone hole, changes in stratification because of increased meltwater from West Antarctica. But there is a more complex picture there that doesn't form neatly in a line. But in the Arctic, there's a very clear relationship between temperature and sea ice extent, and that is that's following the patterns that we have expected. And then finally, people are always asking, of course, why do we think this is going on? The attribution of these long-term trends is a complicated fingerprinting exercise where we look at multiple variables throughout multiple layers of the atmosphere in the ocean, across the land, across multiple data sets, where we're looking to see whether the fingerprint of greenhouse gases or the sun or volcanoes or land use change is the most coherent with the data sets that we have put together. The three pictures that you can see in front of you are taken from the latest IPCC report, and they show that when we include all forcings, those are human, natural, both in the atmosphere and at the surface, we get a very good match to those long-term trends. If we only include natural forcings, we do not get a good match, and in fact, the observed data is roughly 5 sigma outside of what you would expect just from the natural forcings. And if you try and break out which part of the human forcings are contributing the most to that trend, then the third figure shows quite clearly that it's the greenhouse gas trends that are responsible for the majority of the trend that we've actually seen. We can go back through that many ways, but the key thing that we're talking about here is not just 2014, but the long-term trends. And the reason why that's important is because the trends in greenhouse gases are continuing, and so we may anticipate further record highs in the years to come. So with that, we can go over to questions from any of the people.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all the speakers. Again, we'll now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to clearly indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if at all possible. And operator, can you please remind the participants how they can ask a question, and please queue up the first call.
Yes, thank you. At this time, we would like to begin the question and answer session of the conference. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1. To withdraw your question, press star, then 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star one. One moment, please, to see if we have questions. Your first question comes from Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for doing this. The question I have is, when you include all the data from even the areas where you don't have a long-term record, does that change the results any? And also, what kind of... I guess gaps in the data that you'd like to see filled, and what efforts are being made to do that?
Tom?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Obviously, one of the areas that have been very important for us over the last two decades is the increase in observations from the oceans. And this is primarily due to an increased effort by many of the countries, including our own, to put buoys into the ocean. These are buoys that have to be refreshed on a regular basis. So one of the areas that we know continually improves our capabilities are those additional observations from buoys. They supplement many of the observations we have from ship obs, also the moored buoys. We continue to maintain those. Those are particularly useful for us in calculating long-term trends of temperature.
If I could add in a pitch for data recovery as well, there's a lot of station data that has been recorded in stations all across the world that has not yet been digitized. Some of that goes back to the early 1800s. We're very supportive of efforts to digitize those and kind of fill in some of the gaps, which are not observing gaps, but just recording gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Next call, please.
Your next question comes from Seth Borenstein from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I guess this is for Gavin and Tom, if you want to jump in, too. And Gavin, you mentioned this at the very end. You say the way the trends are continuing greenhouse gases, you anticipate further record highs to come. If 2015 turns out to be an El Nino year, however small, how likely do you think it is, given the background of the greenhouse gas warming and a El Nino? How likely is it that you think that we'll break the record this year, 2015, and if not this year, in the next few years? I mean, it seems like the records are breaking every few years now. And then the second part, just, you know, to be really blunt, can you say that the burning of fossil fuels has played a role in specifically 2014? Yeah, just bluntly, 2014's temperature readings.
Thank you, Seth. I can't give you a probability for a record this year. I'd have to actually go back and do some calculations for that. But what I can tell you is that the biggest determinant of whether an El Nino affects the temperature is whether you get an El Nino in the last 3 months of the previous year, and that's got the highest correlation to the anomaly in the following year because of the lag that it takes for information in the tropical Pacific to kind of propagate out around the world. We haven't had an El Nino in the last 3 months, though it has been above zero. And so that is going to push 2015, if everything went according to that regression, a little bit warmer. But I can't give you a specific probability of a new record. We have had back-to-back records like that before, 97, 98, 88, 89, I think. So that wouldn't be unprecedented, but I can't give you an actual probability.
But you wouldn't be surprised if it, I guess, is my question.
Well, I mean, the basic issue is that we've got a rising baseline, and then we have, you know, interannual variability on top of that. Where that's favorable towards warmer conditions, you're going to see new records along the lines of what we've seen. The previous three warmest years were all El Nino years at the beginning of the year, and while this one wasn't, it would not surprise me at all if the next year that started off with an El Nino would also have a record high year.
Thank you.
Oh, there was a second part of your question, right, which was to what extent you can attribute a single year. You can attribute the long-term trends to the four things. The specific year, which one is a record versus which one is not a record, is not attributable to greenhouse gases per se, but the long-term trend upon which these variations are, like the kind of bumps and wiggles, that is attributable. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Next question comes from Justin Gillis from the New York Times. Your line is open.
Thank you, gentlemen, for doing this. Tom, could you talk about the sort of dipole pattern, the kink in the jet stream over the United States that gave us sort of unusually cool conditions in the east and, of course, record warmth in a bunch of states in the west? I guess if you would remark upon just, how odd is that by kind of historical standards, and also give us your thinking about your latest thinking about whether one can attribute that to the loss of Arctic sea ice, as some scientists seem to think.
Thanks for the question. It's a great question. One thing I would say is the pattern we saw last year is not atypical of patterns we've seen in the past. Typically what happens with that pattern, I know that the polar vortex was noteworthy in the news, but in terms of the climatological, meteorological circles, it's often referred to as the Arctic Oscillation, and it manifests itself occasionally, and sometimes some years fairly significantly, but typically what happens is that it's associated with what you saw last year, often other parts of the globe, particularly warm, with the ridge, as meteorologists describe it, high amplitude warming in the western part of the U.S., very persistent condition. So last year, that anomaly was particularly relevant through the winter into the summer in the middle part of the country in the U.S. However, if you take a look at the rest of the globe, you can see the influence of rather mild conditions, a jet stream that really didn't have the impact of cooling off the other parts of the globe. So I think that we should expect these kinds of patterns to occur, and it just so happened that 2014, the U.S. was in the middle of the Arctic Oscillation. If you remember 2012, we led all the other areas with record warm. So as Gavin mentioned, there's considerable interannual variability on top of the longer-term trends and changes that we're seeing.
Thank you. Next question, please.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one. Your next question comes from Craig Welch from the National Geographic. Your line is open.
Thank you all for being here. Could you briefly just touch on some other superlatives from the last year? Anything that would just sort of highlight what... I understand that Anchorage didn't get below zero. Just any other superlatives you could think of, and also I would appreciate somebody just being able to explain for lay people what this says about the supposed hiatus.
I'll take the second part of that question. Meanwhile, Tom can look in his thesaurus for a list of appropriate superlatives.
Thank you.
The hiatus question is a kind of complicated one. If you look at the slides, you'll see that 1998 was a standout year. if you draw a line basically from the top of that to where we are now, it doesn't look like it's moved very much. But actually, if you look at what we would have predicted in 1997, so say take a trend from say 1970 to 1997, and then continue that trend up till 2014, you land almost exactly on where we are. So 2014 is exactly where we would have expected before 1998. So you can get, I think, a little, you can spend a little too much time worrying about short-term trends that aren't part of the long-term, change. There's no evidence, if you look statistically, for a change in the trend at a breakpoint in 1997 or 1998, if you're putting a line through things. And so there are going to be periods when, you know, short-term trends go up and go down. That's just the nature of the beast. But there's no evidence that the long-term trend is really much different from what it has been.
Great. Thank you.
There's a number of statistics that might be of interest. Now, obviously, there was a number of states in the U.S. that had their all-time highest record in 2014. A number of countries in Europe, Denmark and Sweden, for example. Finland saw its second warmest year on record. There was a significant portions of Australia that saw record warmest. And I think you could say the same for parts of eastern Siberia, even into areas in South America. In fact, maybe a statistic you could consider is that every continent had some aspect of record high temperatures.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question, operator.
Your next question comes from Susan Goldenberg from Guardian. Your line is open.
Oh, hello. Thank you for doing this call. I wanted you to speak specifically to the warming of the oceans and what this now means for global weather patterns and, you know, jet stream, et cetera, other coral bleaching and other phenomena. And the second half of that would be looking at the current trends that we've now seen. Where do you think we will be in terms of temperature rise in 2100, and what are the implications of that?
So this is Tom Carl. Gavin, you might want to take some of this as well. Clearly, what we know is when you warm up the oceans, they tend to have a much slower response than when you warm up the land. So the fact that the oceans have been many months in 2014 record warm, even if conditions were to change this year with a significant event, imagine a volcano or other natural event, it'll take a while for the oceans to cool down. So that gives some added energy for 2015. And the ocean temperatures are the patterns of the ocean temperatures are often very important for helping us to explain weather, the kind of weather we get. So it isn't necessarily the fact that all of the ocean is warm, but the patterns in the ocean. And again, this is going to the question earlier with the rather incipient weak El Nino, whether that will occur this year and whether or not it will redevelop later this year into the winter. Those could have important impacts with respect to the weather patterns we see. Certainly, we mentioned coral bleaching. NOAA does have a coral bleach watch. We do take a look at the areas around the globe that have known impact with respect to both temperature in terms of what amount of bleaching is possible. And with these warm temperatures in the ocean, that then increases the likelihood of coral bleaching. Gavin, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, that's pretty much it.
Thank you. Next question, please.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one. Your next question comes from Irene Coates from Reuter. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. I also would like to know the answer to the last question that was asked about what these trends show. And also, I'm sorry if I missed this or I don't see it, but what actually is the average temperature in 2014 in either Celsius or Fahrenheit? And at what point, at what temperature, what does the temperature need to be to where things would kind of look and be a lot different on Earth?
Can I take that last part first? This is Gavin here. So estimates of the absolute temperature of the planet are actually much harder than estimates of the average anomaly, which is what we're really, which is what we're reporting here today. We don't have, if you think about absolute temperatures, they change quite dramatically from ground level to up the side of a hill to on a side where it's shady versus not shady, whether it's under trees or not under trees. And we don't really have a great estimate of those things. The anomalies that we're reporting are actually have a much greater spatial footprint. So if you know the anomaly in, for instance, New York City, that's very highly correlated to the anomaly in Montreal or in D.C. or in Chicago. And so you have a less need for very detailed information to estimate that accurately. So the GIST record doesn't really, we don't really report the absolute values, though Tom might be able to give you a little bit more background for the numbers that they give.
I wasn't really asking about the absolute temperature. I really wanted to know what is the average temperature that you're reporting for 2014, and then at what point, sort of projecting into the future, does the increase in the average temperature become a concern for kind of our day-to-day life on Earth?
Right. Well, the temperature that we're reporting today is around 0.9 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level, so above the level in the 19th century. For impacts to be felt, we're already feeling impacts from even that, impacts will continue to increase as that temperature anomaly tends to increase. But the impacts will be seen in heat waves, in rising sea level, in increased intensity of precipitation, and various, mountain glacier melts, ecosystem shifts, problems with agriculture and the like. The IPCC reports go through all of that in great detail. There isn't going to be one number, though, that is the difference between a world that is unaffected by global warming and then a world that is totally devastated by global warming. It's something that is the impacts are going to increase as the anomalies increase.
Thanks. Let me try this one more time. I mean, in 2013, the average temperature from NASA was 58.3 degrees, and NOAA's was 58.12 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the number for 2014?
So that's the absolute temperature of the globe. I tried to explain that I don't like that because the evidence, the accuracy on that number is not as large as the accuracy is not as good as for the anomalies. So I don't think that that's quite justified to two decimal places.
Okay, next question, please.
Your next question comes from Peter Spott from Christian Science Monitor. Your line is open.
Well, thank you very much for doing this. And actually, this is just a procedural question. Do these numbers get revised? And if so, about how long, before, quote-unquote final numbers come out, or is this it? And if there are revisions, are there any expectations that a hundredth of a degree here or a few hundredths of a degree there may change any of what you've given us today?
Yeah, this is Tom Carl. We, just so everybody's clear, as part of the scientific effort, we continue to try to improve our data sets. And right now, the data that you heard reported to is based on a version for our land data. It's 3.22. So you can imagine there's been a number of updates over the number of years. For our ocean data, it's version 3B. We will be, during the course of this coming year, bringing in improvements in the data, and we expect to bring in updated versions of both land and ocean data. But I can tell you from the work that we're doing now, the picture we're presenting today with respect to record warm temperatures is not going to change.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from Monica Garrett from CNN. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. This is Chad Myers. I'll take the question. Talking about feedback here, if the oceans are getting warmer, and so will the upcoming El Niños become more severe because the potential water pool will be warmer, or can they become less severe because the delta between warm and very warm may be less? Do you guys any responses to that?
So that's still very much an open question. There's been good science that has suggested that you would tend to get more La Niñas in a warmer world, and there's equally good science, as far as I can tell, that suggests the opposite. So I would put that as very much an open question. The problem with that is that the ENTO system itself is highly chaotic and has a lot of structure to, you know, when there's an event, how long they take, how severe they are, that we haven't fully characterized. And so detecting a change there is actually a very large challenge for us. But I can't really say much more than that today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from Chris Holly from the Energy Daily. Your line is open.
Hi, gentlemen. If I heard Gavin correctly, he said that the three previous record years were all El Nino years. And with this new record, we're not seeing yet an El Nino. And I'd like you to discuss the significance of the fact. I mean, my understanding was, as Gavin mentioned, 98 was a fairly spectacular year driven by a very strong El Nino. But now we have a new record that wasn't driven by an El Nino. So what does that say about climate change?
Yeah, this is Tom. I just want to interject just to make sure we're all clear. Not every El Nino year is a record. And, in fact, for example, in 1990, the record at that time occurred in 1990 in our data set. It was not an El Nino year.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly El Nino adds additional heat that makes it more likely that you're going to have a record year, but we shouldn't be misled by the notion that just because there's an El Nino, it's going to be a record warm year.
I see.
Right. I mean, there's another example is, of course, 2002, which was a very warm year. That was followed by 2003, which was an El Nino year. But that was slightly cooler. I mean, in general, the El Nino years are warmer than the La Nina years, and the neutral years are in between. But, you know, it's a statistical correlation. It's not prescriptive.
I see. Thank you.
Next question, please.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star, then one. Your next question comes from Matt Simons with CCTV America. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks, all, for doing this. You mentioned earlier, Tom, just a moment ago, about constantly trying to improve data sets. And, Mike, you mentioned earlier three space missions, if you will, the first of which is being installed pretty much as we speak now on the space station. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're hoping to learn from these space missions in general, and specifically with this so-called CATS mission?
Yes, thanks for the question. This is Mike Freilich at NASA headquarters. The CATS mission, the Cloud Aerosol Transport System instrument, looks at the types and roles of aerosols and clouds in the Earth system, and in particular, how they affect the Earth's radiation balance and the atmosphere. By making precise measurements of the types of aerosols and their density and locations of occurrence, the instrument will allow us to better determine one of the key uncertainties right now in the Earth's energy balance, which is how much energy is reflected back out of the atmosphere into space by aerosols and how much is trapped in the atmosphere by heating up of aerosols. So that's basically CATS in a nutshell.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from Tracy Samuelson with MI Radio. Your line is open.
Hi, it's Michigan Radio, and I know you have, you know, you've got the ocean data and the land data. I'm wondering, given my proximity to a lot of very large bodies of fresh water, whether that data was incorporated into your report. And then I have a second kind of quirky question, given your nearness to this data, which could be considered alarming. Have any of you made any personal changes, personal lifestyle changes?
So I can take your question on the data around the Great Lakes. Indeed, we do have a considerable number of observing systems around the Great Lakes, and that is included in our analysis.
With respect to that second part of your question, you know, it's a question that climate scientists get asked a lot. There are things that people individually can do to reduce their carbon footprint, like, you know, having better appliances, driving less, walking more, biking. I try and do those things. It's a little bit tricky. But I think the best effort that we can make individually on this topic is really to raise awareness, to discuss the scientific findings, to try and help decision makers here and around the globe understand that this is an issue that is not going to go away. And I think we spend a lot of time doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star, then one. Your next question comes from Matt Smith with Vice News. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. This question is for either Tom or Gavin. A lot of talk about the highs obviously being the headline here. What about some of the lows? Were the anything notable about the cold spots in terms of their number or magnitude in this year's data? How do they stack up against previous years, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, it was the this is Tom Carl. It was the coldest winter in the Midwest last year, and I have to say probably about the last three or four decades. But in terms of absolute coldest, there just aren't the statistics there. You know, certainly individual days, you know, record cold, you can find them. But if you average over month and certainly seasons and years, despite the fact that it was cold, you just don't get that record.
Okay. So no real record lows, no notable?
Well, certainly record lows, but largely individual days.
Right.
Not necessarily seasons or months.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question, please.
Your next question comes from Irene Coates from Reuters. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks again. Maybe Tom could take a crack at this, and I'm sorry if I'm just being really dense, but last year at this press conference, you did give us the specific average temperature numbers, and I'm not understanding why they're not available now. And also, if you're saying that the average temperature is 0.9 degrees above the pre-industrial age, it seems that that's a pretty basic arithmetic question to just add the two together. So I'm just not understanding why that number is not available.
Okay, this is Tom Carl. You know, certainly we do have the numbers available. Gavin, you know, gave you the number. We've got 58.2 degrees Fahrenheit for the average temperature for 2014. However, as Gavin pointed out, that number is subject to some significant uncertainties in terms of, as we refer to it, you know, the absolute average for the Earth. And that's because one of the important aspects here is one would have to make an estimate for all the changes in elevation across all the land areas. And so what we do, and what Gavin was trying to explain, we take differences from longer-term mean temperatures because we know those are much more spatially consistent. And the best way I can describe this to you is imagine if you're in a location that has mountains, where I live here in Asheville, North Carolina. We're at 2,000 feet, and we're within 28 miles of Mount Mitchell, which is 6,800 feet. The temperature is quite different between where we are here at the river valley floor and on top of Mount Mitchell. That climate is much more like living in southern Canada. Huge difference. So what climatologists do is they take a look at the departure from the average temperature at Mount Mitchell and that departure from average temperature down here in the valley, and that difference is much more likely to be very similar as compared to the absolute temperature difference. So, for example, if it's warm down here on a sunny day, it's going to be warm on Mount Mitchell on a sunny day, but it will still be substantially colder than it is here. So climatologists make use of that relationship, and that's why we have more confidence in these anomaly numbers than these absolute numbers that have been reported. We do make an estimate of it, but we don't have as much confidence.
So does that revise at all what the interpretation of, like, last year's data is?
No. No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from John O'Connell from Capital Press. Your line is open.
Thank you. I saw a report from some scientists in Alabama. He said it was the third warmest year in 2014, and they used satellite data. I was wondering if you might address why your method is better than using satellite data alone, which would seem to be more consistent or at least simpler.
Can I address that? Thanks for that question. The record that they're talking about is the lower troposphere record, so it's not at the surface. It's measuring something different to what the meteorological station data and ocean surface data are measuring. But it's an important component of the system. One of the things that makes it a little bit different from the surface is that I think, as Tom mentioned earlier on, it has a much greater sensitivity to El Nino events in the tropical Pacific than the surface data does. So that means that when we had that really big El Nino in 97-98, that clearly stands out in their record. Some like little back-of-the-envelope calculations I was doing this yesterday, though, suggest if you correct for El Nino events and ENTO activity, their record would also have shown that last year was the warmest year as well. So it's really, they're seeing something that has a different projection of El Nino than we're seeing at the surface, but they're basically consistent.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from Bud Ward with Yale Climate Connections. Your line is open.
It's a little bit of a follow-up on Craig Welsh's earlier question about the hiatus. The release you all put out refers to the role of El Nino and La Nina in the flattening of the long-term warming trend over the past 15 years. Are we any closer to estimating how much longer that that pause or flattening is going to continue, at least in terms, can we talk about its expected duration, at least in terms of decades, if not in terms of years?
I'll give a very brief answer to that. We do not expect it to persist. And the reason why we don't think it will persist is that the increase in greenhouse gases is unrelenting, and that in the end is going to dominate most of the other things that are going on. There's been some, some efforts to look at volcanic emissions over the last decade, and to see if that has a short-term impact. That seems likely that there is an issue there. The sun was a little bit dimmer, but not by very much. In 5-10 years' time, the change in greenhouse gases dominates all of those things. So I do not anticipate that the hiatus, so to speak, will persist, even if people start to play more sophisticated statistical games with it.
Thank you. Okay, I think we have one final call or one final question. Can you please queue that up? Thanks.
Your last question comes from Matt Simons from CCTV America.
So, and then the hypothetical, I know no one likes to play hypotheticals. Thanks for taking a second question from me. So given the amount that the oceans have already warmed, and you indicated that the fact that they are warming, it's significant as well because it takes longer. So given the amount that they've already warmed, the amount of emissions already in the atmosphere, if all the emissions stopped right now, January 16th, how would 2015 stack up in terms of warmest years?
I think we'd have to do some research to answer that question. It's a great question, but I'm certainly not prepared to give you a number.
It wouldn't affect it very fast. When you got the carbon cycle is slow, the heat in the ocean is slow, and so it wouldn't really affect you in the first year or so. You'd start to see effects in the carbon cycle, after about a decade, and temperature changes would follow that.
Thanks again.
Okay, thank you. I'll now wrap up the call, and thank you to all of our speakers for taking the time and for everyone else for participating in this conference call. If you do have further informational needs, please email Katie Vincent at NOAA.gov, that's katy.vincent at NOAA.gov, or on the NASA side, Leslie McCarthy, that's leslie.m.mccarthy at NASA.gov. Within the next hour or two, an audio of this recording will be posted on the NOAA Media Advisory, the same place where you got the Media Advisory will post the audio. And again, thank you very much. This concludes the call. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference. All participants may disconnect at this time. Thank you.